We all make our way to the ultra-fancy room that I now can afford in my post-private student loan debt world. We will not be at a church. God will be with us in spirit because God is omnipotent, but this won't go down at God's house. Maybe we'll be at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. Perhaps we'll be at a garden, albeit a garden located somewhere in the country where it won't be unbearably hot or too damn cold. Extremes only work for me if I am ordering Popeyes following a long night of drinking or a good old time with some weed. Before I make my way down the aisle, there will be a shot waiting for me at the door, as my nerves will be bad. Plus, why not have one? It's a party after all. Someone will then quickly cue the DJ, and my march, which is more like a subtle strut, will begin. The song blaring from the speakers is Beyonce's Get Me Body. My march that's more like a strut soon shifts to a jig. I'm dancing all up and down the aisle, and not long after the wedding attendees rise from their seats at the appropriate time, the call and response portion of the extended mix, obviously, proceeds to drop down and sweep the floor with it. Preferably, Beyonce is there in person. Like, we should be besties by then. If not, she will at least be there in spirit because I carry her with me wherever I go. Duh. I'm not doing that gender nonsense where one groom does the bride part and the other groom is the manly man. The other groom will get his moment down the aisle too. Just my luck, he'll pick some song I hate like Thong Song or One Sweet Day, but since I love him, whatever. Have your moment, dude. I'm totally kidding. I would never marry anyone who still listens to the Thong Song. At best, he can get away with Cisco's Got to Get It. The reception will be catered by the No Limit gold-selling female rapper and legend Mia X, who has since started cooking. She will do double duty with a performance of Party Don't Stop. My husband and I will fill in for Foxy Brown and Master P. Master P will probably charge too much, and while I adore Fox Boogie, she is an insurance risk. She once performed at a New York Black Pride event and fell off the stage. I don't have the time to worry about rap royalty tripping over their 37,000-inch weave on my watch. The reception will be an all-night party. I'm not cheap, so the bar will be open, though I might require that the alcohol be served in either a champagne flute or a red solo cup. The combination is me in a nutshell. Country as hell, but into nice things when I can afford them. For those who require an emotional roller coaster at a wedding, I'll definitely include cry-inducing songs. Once all that wraps, we'll go to whatever island that won't be in some ferocious hurricane's path that summer. Scratch that. We're going somewhere inland with a pool. He'll deal. I can't swim anyway. The only other wedding option I have since thought of goes like this. I wake up early one Sunday morning, bop my man on the head in bed and say, yo, we really need to get this arrangement on paper. What if my clumsy ass falls down somewhere and breaks a leg and finds out I have some kind of rare disease and your ass can't see me in the hospital? And then we run down to the courthouse or whatever. Maybe get some Chick-fil-A afterward for irony's sake. That's equally romantic and cheaper. Most of the conversations that I have about marriage are with straight people. And whenever the subject of marriage comes up with the straights, I am either going along with the conversation for the sake of not playing spoiler or assuring my friends that no matter what article is floating across social media, there is still hope that they will get married and put some buns in that oven. In truth, though, as optimistic as I can be for others about the subject, I have long maintained ambivalence towards the institution of marriage. For most of my life, I did not have to tackle those mixed feelings. I could put them on the sidelines and let them fester because it was not as if the freedom to marry a man was a nationwide right. Little by little did that start to change, depending on the state, and as the marriage equality wave spread, I eventually had a seat directly in front of the possibilities. In 2014, I attended a gay wedding. Darrence, whom I knew from high school, was marrying Nick Denon, whom I didn't know personally, but who I certainly recognized as the founder of Gawker. The wedding was at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. It was both the first time I saw two dudes tie the knot and the first time I had seen more than two people from high school outside of Houston. The latter of which was the more surprising aspect of the day. It was also my first fancy wedding, as evidenced by the fact that it was covered by the New York Times. If you want to feel poor, attend a 1% wedding. Like me, Darren's had a strong affinity for Queen Bee, which was why I heard a pianist play the instrumental of Dangerously in Love so much throughout the ceremony. I came with Dre. It was a black tie affair, so I had ended up buying a tuxedo, assuming that if I worked in media and lived in New York City, I'd presumably be required to wear one every so often. The wedding and the reception were a nicely blended mix of the groom's two very different backgrounds. Every table at the reception was a mixed crowd of both their respective families and friends. I enjoy watching rich white people marvel at the crawfish etouffee in front of them. To be fair to the northerners who prepared the meal, it was pretty solid. Lord knows folks up north don't know a thing about slap your mama seasoning. While I was ecstatic for Darren's and happy to reconnect with old classmates and friends, at no point did I stop that evening and think, this could be me. This was Darren's and Nick's moment. I was just happy to see them happy, but not thinking that type of happiness was something I could have or even want. However, the question would soon command larger scrutiny, as nearly a year after I attended that big great gay wedding, on June 26, 2015, the Supreme Court made same-sex marriage legal nationwide. I've donated money to causes supporting marriage equality initiatives in various states and to nationwide efforts. I've written about marriage equality as part of my work as a political commentator. I've argued with various simpletons who struggle to understand that the religious fables they were told about marriage don't quite match up to the actual history of it. That Adam and Eve don't have a damn thing to do with marriage, and that holy matrimony begins as a means to establish property rights. That marriage is determined by the state, not a church, and if the state can recognize common law marriage without great protest, heterosexuals can shut themselves up and let the gays get married too. So, as far as justice goes, I was overjoyed when the Supreme Court ruled that every same gender-loving individual had as much right to become a divorcee as the straights. Yet as a personal matter and for what the decision meant for my life, I wasn't moved. My friends surely were, though. I think a lot of that has to do with love is love so often being the uniting messaging behind equality for LGBTQ rights. I've long struggled with that because there is more to me than who I love, and love itself is far more complicated than slogans make it out to be. As soon as the ruling was announced, Kim, who, as you'll recall, is my closest friend from high school and one of the few folks from Houston I've managed to remain close to over the last 20 years, called me in complete jubilee. Bitch, are you crying? She very much was. Kim will tell you that she's a thug, and while there is indeed a Rap-A-Lot Records element to her, Chief Justice Roberts' choice not to be completely useless brought out the Celine Dion ballad in her. I loved how happy she was for me. I appreciated how much this historic moment meant to her as the friend of a gay man. Of course, I couldn't help but joke that I didn't have a man and so was in no position to get married anytime soon. Kim chuckled at the quip, but she remained optimistic about my future both individually and as a part of the community. More calls and texts came, including from those who recalled my self-described dream wedding from a drunken brunch. To their collective delight, I performed elation the way they wanted to hear from me. It wasn't the time to piss on marriage and bring up my issues. Once again, I opted out of rocking the boat. Before I even accepted that I was gay, I had already soured on the idea of getting married. It wasn't because I didn't think gay marriage was a possibility at the time. Even when marriage equality was nothing more than a pipe dream, I resented marriage and found it to be something that probably wouldn't work for me. I wish my hesitation had been majorly rooted in the question of whether or not such a heteronormative institution fit my gay ass, or if expressing immediate glee over the Supreme Court ruling meant I was genuflecting to norms not designed with me in mind anyway. In panels, I've heard others shout about that while highlighting that polyamorous relationships and other kinds of romantic and sexual arrangements that break tradition should be exalted the same way monogamous relationships, like marriage, are. I feel their pain, but that ain't got shit to do with me. My uneasiness with marriage mirrors that of so many others. My parents' marriage haunts me. My parents are still married, though I'm not particularly sure why. Granted, it's ultimately none of my business, but as a byproduct of their relationship, I reserve the right to remain both curious and puzzled. I usually say each is waiting for the other to die. Apparently, patience is a good way to prevent premeditated murder. Whenever I make this comment, people assume that I am being facetious. It's likely because I say it so matter-of-factly, but it's how I feel based on my observations and experiences. I constantly live with the fear that my dad would make good on his threats to kill my mom. I'm surprised my mom hasn't killed him. I used to offer to be a character witness or an alibi if she needed one. I've made peace with the reality that as a victim of physical, verbal, and mental abuse, my dad is just a symptom of a disease that has soiled so many members of our family. I would not say I've forgiven him for the terror he put on all of us, but I have learned to accept the reasons why he ended up the way he did and love him in spite of that. As a young adult, I asked my mother why she kept us in that household of madness. Why did she put up with him? Why didn't she free her own self from the burdens of being with him? I asked this when I was in college in order to deal with the resentment I had toward her for keeping us in that environment for so long. She responded that she simply didn't want to end up on welfare raising multiple kids. I couldn't argue with that. I was not trying to victim blame. I just wanted clarity on what her thinking was. Likewise, I wanted to know if the pressures from work and marriage were why, though she may have loved her kids dearly, she wasn't always kind to us. Though my dad often used to say, "Don't ever get married," my mom never discouraged marriage. She encouraged it, albeit slanted toward holy matrimony with the woman. Bless her heart. She also encouraged my sister to get married. I don't recall my sister ever wanting to do so. She did, however. There was no formal wedding ceremony. She just casually told me she was married over the phone long after the fact, and right as she was on the verge of divorcing her husband. As she was telling me about the divorce, she mentioned that our mama was the one who had pushed for her to get married in the first place. My response was immediate. Why would you listen to her? My sister is amazing. She's one of the strongest, hardest working people I have ever met. She's a remarkable human being. However, much like I saw with my folks, I looked at how remarkable people could be put through so much needless strain thanks to marriage. Well, with the wrong people anyway. The failure to learn how to love someone properly is a trait that has since been passed down to me. I know it isn't right to base the failures of your parents on anything you do, but we are all products of our living experiences. Generally, I didn't grow up seeing a lot of people in what I'd consider to be happy marriages. I barely saw married couples, period, outside of a few family members. When I think about the kind of commitment that most people associate with marriage, I think about people losing. Losing themselves, their dreams, or at the very least a part of their happiness. And though I really am happy gay people are making strides in our efforts to have our love recognized fairly in terms of property taxes and medical visits, I struggle to wrap my head around the idea of ever making that kind of move myself. It took a while, but I finally started to say these things to people out loud, foregoing my fears of how jaded I sounded. But as a believer in the mantra, "You don't have to get ready if you stay ready," I would have my defensive talking points prepared. If I don't end up with anyone or like get married and shit, I'll still lead a happy and fulfilling life. I may never be married, but that doesn't mean I failed as a person. Nor does it mean being unmarried means I will be lonely. A friend called me on something. Why would you shut down the possibility before it even happens? That doesn't sound like you. No, it doesn't. My preoccupation with making sure I never do to another what I think my father has done to my mother has made me needlessly cautious about entering an institution that I have found creates more problems than solves them. The fact that I have thought about this so much suggests that I'm already ahead of most people when it comes to taking marriage seriously. Another challenge is that there are not litanies of healthy gay marriages out there to be held up and learned from. The bright side of this is that I might be able to set my own rules and boundaries, ones that work for me and my needs. To that end, I can think of a few rules. As previously acknowledged, he must accept Beyonce as his lord and gyrator. I do not believe in betheism. No, no, no. He must accept that I will probably always have a craving for fried catfish on Friday. Even if I do not eat fried catfish every Friday, he should try not to read me for craving it. That would be culturally insensitive. He must not judge me for wanting to watch Love and Hip Hop and The Real Housewives. The same goes for Lawrence O'Donnell's show on MSNBC. I feel like Lawrence is me as an old white guy and we have a spiritual bond mere mortals cannot fathom. And he better watch Joanne Reed with me, although I've noticed she has developed quite a following with the gays because she serves more reads than a 24-hour library. He must understand my need to sing Cut Close as I Like at least 5 times a week out loud. The same goes for Kelly Price's Don't Say Goodbye. It's a thing for me. Oh yeah. Hashtag that ass. This doesn't mean I'm suddenly back to dreaming of a wedding day. I am still not addicted to the code of marriage or preoccupied with the idea that it's a milestone that must be reached. I know so many straight people like this. Frankly, they all seem crazy as hell. But it is nice to know that for so long the rest of us have been deprived of this kind of crazy, and I finally get to partake in it too. And in doing so, I can shake off the stigmas I once applied to marriage because of the folks who made me. I don't have to let the past dictate my lifestyle choices. So if marriage happens, awesome. And if it doesn't, oh well. Okay, one change of plans if it does happen. Maybe instead of "Get Me Body," I should bop down the aisle to Formation. That feels more appropriate. The pink print. I don't care about white people like that. That's not to say I carry with me some pointed, irrational hostility toward white people. Granted, when I find instances of white folks engaging in some sort of racist stunt, I will look at black folks and other non-whites, let out an audible sigh, and maybe voice a comment such as white people. But no, I do not specifically abhor white people. I spread my hatred evenly, the way God intended. When I say I don't care about white people like that, I am referring to whiteness. Whiteness is why white people are placed higher in the social hierarchy than everyone else who isn't white. Whiteness fuels racism, and that racism is designed to protect whiteness and the aforementioned hierarchy at the expense of everyone else. Whiteness is so pervasive and so powerful that I have to explain that when I say I don't care about white people like that, I have to be very clear that I don't mean I hate all white people, because it would be catastrophic for me to utter such a declaration. White men and women can create media companies, businesses, and accrue political power based on anti-blackness. But even though I would never want to do the same with some similar shtick centered around contempt for white people, the fact is that such an option would never be afforded to me in the first place, since only white people can hate without repercussions, like that punk-ass 45th president of the United States of America. Whether white people want to admit it or not, whiteness by and large informs their outlook on everything. How could it not? They sit at the top of the food chain in society, so their standards are considered, well, the standard. Whiteness is so pervasive and so powerful that many make it seem as if whatever opinion whiteness and white people have is of greater value. But I don't care about white people and whiteness like that, because I wasn't raised to pay white people and their whiteness much mind. This had to do with not being around white people much at all growing up. They were not prevalent in my neighborhood. Outside of middle school, I didn't see much of them in my K-12 schooling because I primarily attended predominantly black and Latino schools growing up. Even when I was a magnet student and saw a handful of white students in middle school, we still didn't have the same classes. I can remember three white teachers in my entire K-12 life. The first was a very young white woman who came across as one of those people who planned to teach at a black school for a short spell before applying to law school. Indeed, she was gone the following year. Another taught choir and was very upset about O.J. Simpson's acquittal. The last one wasn't necessarily the Tina Marie of white teachers, but she definitely conveyed a level of comfort about being around a bunch of black and brown faces. So yeah, outside of those three and the handful of white kids in middle school, that was it. Houston was an incredibly diverse city, but I saw white people only in doses depending on the setting. For example, I saw them at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, because it was the sort of big event that brought people together. Then again, I only went to the rodeo on what was commonly referred to as Black Night, because it featured performers like Luther Vandross, Gladys Knight, Destiny's Child, or Beyonce when she went solo, Monica and Brian McKnight, while also honoring the contributions of black cowboys. So yes, I saw a few white people the same way I saw them when I would go to the Galleria, the really nice mall with all the fancy department stores, as opposed to the black mall known as Sharpstown a few minutes away. Or at Astroworld, the now demolished amusement park, or maybe the museum or the zoo. But even in those instances, I recall a few times when I ever interacted with white people. If I did, it was incredibly surface level because Southerners are ultra polite. Much of this is rooted in socioeconomic status. As a black person growing up working class, by default, white people didn't want to live by me, go to school with me, or be in most of the same social settings as me. My neighborhood and schools each represented the inner city that is so often discussed in media, but most frequently by white people who don't know the people in those spaces. We are treated dismissively, as products of our environment and as people whose fate is sealed. So no, it's not about any bias, but merely seeing myself in Nord and responding in kind. I didn't fixate on white people and whiteness because it was well established that, as a collective, they found no value in me. Nevertheless, I knew black people were of value. Despite not growing up wealthy and despite being effectively segregated by way of that status, my mother made it clear that black people were not deficient. She took me to black doctors and dentists as a child. Although she couldn't afford it, when she did want to place my brother and me in private school, it was the Amani School, a private Christian school run by the Windsor Village Methodist Church, a hugely popular and predominantly black church. She was a devout Catholic, but still wanted us to be at a Christian private school run by black people. Yes, my mom told me about racism, not that it was a hard thing to figure out as an early news junkie, but while it was made clear that I may face certain obstacles, I could overcome them because I'd already seen a wide variety of all the things Black folks could achieve on their own. In hindsight, my mom was preparing me for the times when I would be around white people, and whiteness made certain that I would enter those spaces with a sense of pride. So this is what I mean by not caring about white people like that. Of course, I will always worry about interactions with law enforcement, as those pose life-threatening situations, but overall I look at white people like this. If you don't present prejudice and we can just enjoy each other, awesome. But if not, I will not let it eat me alive because it's whiteness at work and that's not my black ass problem. Yet as someone who now works in media, I realize that my situation is very different from that of many other people. It requires a great degree of sacrifice to work in media. You are expected to intern for little money, if not for free, and then take an entry-level job that will not pay much and possibly lead you to question why you bothered getting a college degree. You do this under the impression that if you continue working hard, you will finally be compensated the way you deserve to be. Most people cannot afford such a sacrifice. Needless to say, I do not come from a background that lends itself to being able to afford such sacrifices, so in a lot of ways, I do find myself to be a bit of an anomaly among other black media folks, because even coming from a solidly middle-class or upper-middle-class background is a distinct advantage that I know nothing about. A lot of black people in media come from worlds I only ever saw on TV when I was growing up. That is, they went to more diverse schools, if not predominantly white ones, whereas I went to Howard, the HBCU. They've had to deal with white people and whiteness for much longer, and while I would never make the sweeping generalization that all of them carry the burdens that come with being a black person in a majorly white space, there are some who do. I feel for them, but I cannot relate to that. I'm lucky to even exist in this space with any of these people whose futures seem more certain than mine. I've learned over time that success in this world has a lot to do with one's proximity to whiteness. People overall value mainstream publications more than they do black media. Part of that is rooted in folks knowing how difficult it is to be able to have your voice in mainstream outlets. Still, I want to be a success, and that entails placing myself in spaces different from those I'm accustomed to. The struggle with that, though, is that I am often asked to lead with my otherness. I don't walk into a space pronouncing to be black or gay. I happen to be black, and I happen to be gay. These things inform my perspective, but I don't believe either requires great announcement. Still, when you are one of a few, you're typically asked to speak from those places. Unfortunately, even when we are asked to write about ourselves, we are often asked to do so within even more rigid prisms. For instance, black outlets and certain newer mainstream outlets run by younger editors will pretty much let me talk about whatever I want, however I want. Well, minus the one time a black male editor younger than I was warned me about using turns of phrase that were too in-group. Translation, stop sounding so black. He cared more about whiteness than I ever will, and I never wrote for him again. Problem solved. In any event, with more traditional outlets, whenever commissioned to write about subject matter that's more personal, I've learned over time that the more pathos is involved, the better it'll be received. You know, because it's so hard to be po-black me. Here are the topics mainstream outlets love for me to write about from the perspective of a gay black man. Black homophobia, AIDS, and sexual racism. I don't mind confronting black homophobia and transphobia, but it's always been twofold for me. I will condemn any mythology that suggests black folks are magically more anti-gay or anti-trans than white people, as if black folks came over on a cruise ship clutching their Bibles while saying they couldn't wait to pick cotton and keep Luther Vandross in the closet, while also calling out black folks for trying to borrow white folks' oppressor baton and use it on issues related to sexuality and gender. As for the AIDS, well, yeah, I get it, and I try to confront the harsh realities of an epidemic that lingers on and on. With respect to sexual racism, I tend to cringe and roll my eyes so fervently that I'm always surprised that at least one of my eyeballs doesn't roll out of its socket to escape the abuse. The reason why I roll my eyes is that I'm supposed to take umbrage at the fact that I do not meet the sexual fantasies of a white man. Why? Because white men are the end-all be-all, don't you know? How could I not be so offended to the point that I must address the matter over and over and over again? Then place the topic in my back pocket and pull it back out on command. Hashtag all white dicks matter or whatever. I remember the one and only time a white boy kissed me. Technically, it was two of them at the same time, but it was spawned by one of them because he kept calling me beautiful in an accent I couldn't quite place. I can make out a British accent, a German accent, a French accent, and maybe an Australian accent, but outside of that, I'm clueless. The best I can do is say the dude sounded like one of the two men Jason Bourne beat the shit out of in The Bourne Supremacy. Anyway, it didn't matter where his speech pattern stemmed from, given that he mainly communicated with me with his tongue. It happened at some white gay club in New York that I never would have gone to if it weren't with Samuel. Someone I met through a scholarship program who was visiting the city at the same time I was back for another internship. Samuel was Mexican from Los Angeles, but he was clearly no stranger to the blacks and was very good at clocking a homosexual. I thought Samuel was a snack when I first greeted him, but I wasn't out, so I never said anything. By the time we did link up, I learned he had quite the appetite for white men, which is why we hung out. He wanted to go to clubs my gay friends from the same area as me in Houston were not at all interested in going to. Samuel, who called me girl every 30 seconds, was high out of his mind and wanted me to at least get drunk so we could go to some spot in Chelsea. The spot was massive and full of shirtless, no body fat having white boys, and quite loudly played the kind of music that just thumps and requires a glow stick and ecstasy to appreciate. I didn't want either, so I had lots of vodka to deal with it. By drink number infinity and beyond, I found my way to the dance floor, and not long after, into that triple kiss. The one who called me beautiful was the one who kissed me first, then he had me kiss his friend, and then he had me kiss the both of them at the same time. Then he kept kissing me. He also grabbed my dick a lot. I hung out with Sam a couple of days later, and once again, it was at some gay bar populated mainly by white gays. I realized Sam's affinity for white men was partially influenced by the access that it provided. He liked white men with money, and regardless of what many gay white men dealt with in terms of homophobia, they remained white men and commanded a kind of social capital that only white men could. Being on the arm of white privilege had its perks, and he enjoyed them. I still did not like those clubs. The little triple kiss was fun, but I wasn't toned enough to leap around shirtless, and if I was at a dance club, I wanted to hear music I could dance to. You cannot body roll to techno, or at least body roll in the manner that I'm accustomed to. Not to mention, Sam got most of the attention and was bound to ditch me. I wasn't sure initially if not being paid much mind in the white gay clubs was directly related to racism. A lot of people have told me that I look unapproachable. I appreciate this one straight black man who was comfortable enough with his sexuality to tell me, "Yo, bro, you do have a resting bitch face. Cut that shit out, bro." I do the best I can, but I normally have to end up approaching people as a result of me being seen as unapproachable. Having said that, I do know the type of men I attract, and they are overwhelmingly not white. Anecdotally, the running logic between my friends and me is that in terms of aesthetic, American white men want black coffee, no sugar, no milk, while the European ones are more into cafe au lait. I never honestly thought about all this at great length until I had been asked by multiple editors on several occasions if I had some story to tell, and then if I had any others. I know that within the last couple of years, there has been a personal essay boom. There is also an insatiable need for content and a desperate need for clicks. All of this explains why across various outlets, but for sure gay publications that are mostly run by white men, there's a constant overflow of pieces penned by black men lamenting white men who don't find them sexually attractive. Most of them read the same. "Oh, white bae, why don't you love me? Please, baby, baby, please, white zaddy, want me. The way I want you. Give me that pumpkin spice latte penis. I need it." The same goes for white men who write pieces claiming that their stance against dating black men, "It's just my preference," does not make them racist by default. For the record, yes the fuck it does. Of course, because video matters more to media outlets with each passing quarter of lackluster advertising revenue, these diatribes have now been flipped to videos. As if the essays weren't painful enough reads, either way, they're heavy-handed and hard for me to read. Look, I understand the frustration. Sexual racism is wrong, and I get that this is a long-standing issue. I know that people should make sure bigots know that they cannot cower behind the false pretense of preference. Yet I am sick of reading and watching black men complain about white men not wanting them sexually. I loathe the immediate assumption that I care that much about whether or not white men find me sexually attractive. You would think that Martin Luther King had a dream that one day a black dick and a pink dick would swore fight and then finish all over the rainbow flag. All too often, when it comes to tackling the relationships between gay black men and gay white men, it is discussed widely within the context of sexual attraction. This places whiteness on a high pedestal and plays into the pathology of minorities. Aw, this black boy just wants some of that pink print. Poor him. I realize that the topic will never disappear because racism is stubborn in that way. But I do find the emphasis on this conversation to be stifling. There are plenty of ways to discuss disparities between white men who don't identify as straight and their non-white counterparts outside of whether or not the latter meets the standards of the former. For instance, in 2015, The Advocate published an essay entitled, "Is Gay Dating Racism Creating a Black HIV Crisis?" To his credit, the author of the piece, Daniel Reynolds, did ultimately speak to someone from the CDC who explained that other factors played a larger role. But the problem with the piece, and there have been many more pieces since then published along the narrative line, was that it did not frame the topic within the right context. Indeed, 2 years before that was published, the New York Times published a report, "Poor Black and Hispanic Men Are the Face of HIV," which examined factors behind higher HIV rates among poor Black and Latino men. In it, they detailed how Black and Latino men were less likely to take drugs before having sex and were no more likely to engage in risky behavior than their white gay counterparts, but that our infection rates were higher all the same. The reason behind the problem at hand had nothing to do with sexual racism and everything to do with the failure of health organizations to reach both groups. Months after reading the essay in The Advocate, I got an email from the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors, NASTAD, announcing the launch of a new online training program to help doctors, nurses, and medical professionals unlearn racial bias and elevate the quality of healthcare for gay black men and black men who have sex with men. In the press release for this initiative, Omara Omohi, Associate Director of Health Equity and Healthcare Access at NASTAD, said, "There's a lot of discussion right now about implicit bias and police brutality in the U.S., but the truth is, this is a huge challenge for healthcare providers as well." For the first few years I lived in Harlem, I walked up and down 125th Street nearly every day. There are a lot of reasons to hate walking up and down 125th. Despite New Yorkers' reputation for being fast walkers, it's a damn lie along the same lines as, "Winters here ain't that bad." There are also the constant cries of, "Black man, let me hold a dollar." Sometimes I do give them a dollar if I have one on me, or I'll at least buy someone standing homeless outside of that Dunkin' Donuts on Lenox coffee and or a breakfast sandwich. But when I don't have it, damn, you ain't gotta cuss at me. I can't forget the men from the Nation of Islam trying to hand me the latest edition of The Final Call that blasts white folks while the religion itself maintains homophobic views. It literally takes everything in me not to hear one of them call me brother without yelling, "Y'all don't like me either, nigga." Sometimes I just want to rap along and bop to Nicki Minaj in peace, you know? What has grated on my nerves the most about 125th Street is that I have only once been asked if I wanted to take an HIV test. Harlem and Washington Heights have some of the highest HIV rates in the area. Where are the people regularly handing out condoms and encouraging tests? Why should I only be offered either during Harlem Pride? I can get a fish sandwich from a solar-powered truck on 125th. I can go to Whole Foods and get some organic chicken wings, turkey legs, and surprisingly well-made macaroni and cheese. Random folks will ask me if I have a kid who needs a checkup or teeth cleaning. If I can get all of that, why can't I get some genuine health outreach? So, when the CDC now claims 1 in 2 gay black men will acquire HIV in their lifetimes, whatever is in someone's grinder box is inconsequential to a problem that is a crisis and can directly impact my life. We can talk about sexual racism, but do not center the fate of a minority health crisis on the sexual desires of white men. To wit, when I finally did start to see ads for PrEP in the Harlem area, they predominantly featured white gay men or white gay men with black gay men. They couldn't have at least put one black couple together in Harlem of all places. Interracial relationships are perfectly fine. I could never fault them because they gave us Mariah Carey and Barack Obama. In the same way Will Smith and Omar Lopez helped me figure out that I like boys more than girls, the same goes for Joey Lawrence, his brother Matthew Lawrence, and Jonathan Taylor Thomas. There are some white men whom I find attractive. I would still take Ryan Phillippe down, and Nick Jonas is more than welcome to join us. Having said that, the imagery isn't lost on me. It does ultimately cause people to believe that is the standard, or at least a type of relationship worth aspiring to have. A white man not wanting me is not the be-all and end-all, though. At this point, I find this topic boring, and I never want to be asked about it again. Why be so focused on the preferences of races? Why help feed the ego of whiteness by centering it? I'd rather run my head into a wall several times, with Ronald Reagan's racist welfare queen speech loudly playing in the background, than boo-hoo about not being black enough for a white boy to want me. If someone's preference is that I am not good enough, oh well, it's their loss. It doesn't require that much of my energy. Someone who values you less will not be convinced by your public crying about wanting to belong. I am less interested in wanting to belong and more passionate about being equal. Not being treated equally is why HIV is a greater reality in my lifetime than it is in the life of a white man. We have to stop giving other people's preferences so much power. We need to value ourselves so much that no outside force, no prejudice, even one disguised as preference, can make us feel second place. I suppose I learned this early, because as a little black boy growing up without wealth in the South, whiteness and white people were already far removed from me. I already knew what price they placed on me, and it was very little. But I didn't need them to tell me of my worth. I want others to have this same feeling, because if you are a non-white person measuring any part of your value based on a system predicated on diminishing you and all those like you, you are on a fool's errand. You can't win by their metric. It's not designed with you in mind. I treat every man, black, white, Latino, Asian, Middle Eastern, indigenous, or whatever the lovely melting pot of bae miscegenation created, who doesn't want me the same way. Fuck him. I'm cute. I'll dial that number. The nightmare has always been the same. My father has reached the maximum potency of his alcohol-induced rage fest, and the main target for his wrath is his wife and my mother. Words are exchanged between the two of them, his profanity-laced tirade shifting to threats on her life, and then it happens. He tries to make good on his threats. I'm present in the room as he attacks her, as he tries to fulfill his long-standing promise to murder her, but I am paralyzed. For the life of me, I can't get to her. I can't stop him from trying to kill her. I am immobile, stuck watching the unthinkable happen right before me, and helpless to stop it. Seconds before she looks to be leaving this world, I am quickly awakened. The reaction to the dream is always the same too. I'm always shaken by what has just happened, and for a few moments, I lie there in my devastation, and my feelings of failure over not being able to stop the tragedy. These nightmares started when I was a child and have followed me through my teenage years and my 20s. As for my 30s, they've happened only 3 times. On back-to-back nights during a trip home for Christmas, and another time when I was visiting a friend who had just suffered the loss of his mother. As much as I love my family, my hometown of Houston, and the friends I still have there, it can be hard for me to go home. Time and distance have helped, but it's difficult to revisit not only the scene of the crimes, but also the visible damage the events in our home have had on the house itself. There was always a build-up to his acting out. My dad, who never exhibited an appreciation for standing still, usually hung around outside, where he could move around with the freedom that his penchant for constant mobility commanded. When he was out there, he'd be cutting the grass, maybe for the billionth time that week, or tending to the flower beds. Or he'd be working on his old truck. Or he'd be standing outside blasting music, anything from Johnny Taylor to the Isley Brothers to Barry White to whatever CD he's pulled out of my sister's car to help him stay current. There was a period when he played Master P's Ghetto D album constantly. He was never alone, though. He was always surrounded by people, friends, and quote-unquote friends alike. They were playing dominoes, some of them smoking, and of course there was a lot of shit-talking happening. Some of those acquaintances presented as friends, but as time went on, all it might take was one miscommunication for an argument to occur, one that may or may not have led to blows. Much of that could be attributed to alcohol, of which there was no short supply. Vodka, cognac, beer, his water, as he'd call so many things. If it wasn't someone else that triggered his anger, it was the baggage he carried inside him. My father was a landmine, and the last thing a person like that needed was to self-medicate with alcohol. But when you didn't have the tools to deal with all that happened to you, you turned to whatever vice you needed in order to get through the seconds, minutes, and hours of a given day. You turned to it when you thought about moments of the previous days, months, years, and decades that continued to torment you. And then you repeated the cycle of your abuses by taking out what ailed you on those closest to you. My mom served that role. Therefore, he would direct his venom at her. Trivial shit would be the jumping point. What she cooked, and how it was not like his cooking, which he didn't cook for him because he suddenly forgot how to cook his own meals. or that she didn't want to engage in his almost childlike need for attention and validation. Not feeding into whatever he felt he needed led to the slamming of cabinets and doors, and then to the snippy remarks. These were all the actions of someone fishing for a reason to be mad and lash out. My dad could be an intimidating presence, but I never witnessed my mom display fear of him. If anything, she mostly responded to his antics by ignoring them. As he screamed, she responded with silence. We all mirrored her response. It was better to pay him no mind rather than allow him the chance to spoil everyone else's mood. But he was so vigilant in his attempts to get a rise out of her, to get her to say something back, to give himself a reason to make it more than it ever needed to be. That was why, after a certain point, he would often manage to get under her skin and get her to respond to his cruelty in kind. My mom was adept at knowing just what to say to fuck his head up, so when he ushered her to her breaking point, she would send him into an even greater tizzy. Once that happened, he would really get going. Fuck you, Di. I'ma kill you, Di. Die, bitch. I swear in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, I'm going to kill you. Dial 911, I'll shoot at them too. Fuck all y'all. These were classic lines from the usual script. He would subject us to blasphemous rants intended to make light of my mom's devout Catholic faith. This only made him appear all the more like the devil. He also often used to shout about resenting not just marriage, but having a family too. I long suspected that neither of them had envisioned being married to each other, much less with a family that effectively kept them bundled together out of financial necessity. But if there had been any lingering doubt, he made sure to confirm it. I didn't doubt that he loved us, but that didn't excuse his behavior. The darkness inside of him and his commitment to cruelty were displayed even more when he would point out the abuse that my mother had endured as a teenager. How did a man do that to his wife and the mother of his children? How did any person do that to even a stranger? And then there were the times he struck her. We would often huddle around her in the living room in preparation for the moment he might dare to do so. Because if he jumped on her, we would all jump on him. That was why he would holler about 911, daring us to dial that number. I vividly remember the one time one of us actually did. He snatched the phone and broke it. The police came anyway. Before answering the door, he hid the guns he had in our home. Once he made his way outside, he put on a show. He was actively resisting arrest. I peeked through the blinds from the bedroom that my brother and I shared. He was in handcuffs, leaning on the car trying to kick his feet in the air to fight off being put inside the police car. He ultimately was placed in the back seat and spent the night in jail. The very next day, I had to get up and go to school. While waiting at the bus stop, a kid named Joe mentioned that he had heard what had happened. I'm sure everyone did. My dad was a very loud person who made sure he knew every single person surrounding us. Yes, that might make him a good neighbor, but that also meant what I had long suspected. Most people knew how he was and could hear his tirades in the middle of the night almost as well as we could. It was embarrassing and something I never talked about. On that morning, as Joe mentioned him to me, it was clear that even if I wasn't talking about myself, others might be. My dad never let us forget the fact that 911 had been called on him. He used it as fodder for future fits and fights. He resented us for what he felt was our having turned on him. That took a lot of nerve, given that he was both parent and tyrant. He never owned what he did. He only gave excuses. Shortly after many of these arguments, he'd enter our room to talk about his past. He had been abused as a child. His father would beat him profusely, even holding a loaded shotgun to his chest. They lived in a house out in the woods in a tiny town called Raywood, Texas. There were not a lot of people around. The homes were not even in close proximity to one another. Still, you could apparently hear my dad's screams from the beatings given by his father. Those were calls for help. Help he never got. He fucked with me, my dad once explained on his knees, full of tears, and red beyond belief. Sometimes he managed to get me to cry along with him. The sympathy would soon dissipate, because he would go back to bothering my mom and keeping us all up for the rest of the night until he decided to go to bed. It was selfish and vile, and those tears were emotionally manipulative. Yes, he provided context for why he was the way he was, but at some point, you had to make a choice to do better. After all, wasn't he cognizant of the underlying issues? But again, he didn't know any better. A lot of the beatings he had endured had occurred because he was trying to defend his mother. I don't know exactly what happened because no one really speaks on this, but I've heard his mother ran off and left him there with his father, his abuser. I used to see his mom growing up, but that stopped after a while. It's a shame not having a connection with members of such a large family, but it's a mess of other people's making that I have no interest in writing. I don't even remember what my dad's father looks like. There are no pictures of him in my home. I know his name was Nelson, and my sister told me that he used to love me. I have no recollection of that, and I don't care. He was a monster that brought havoc, and that trait was passed on like the shape of one's nose. The frequency of these outbursts varied. Sometimes it would be every few weeks, but in other instances, every couple of months. They always happened during the holidays, though notably Mother's Day, Father's Day, and especially Thanksgiving and Christmas. I love Thanksgiving and Christmas, but for as much eagerness as I had for those holidays, there was always trepidation over whether or not he would let his demons ruin our celebrations, as they had ruined so many other things. We used to have other kids over. That was until this one time when my father argued with my mother in the kitchen, grabbed her by the shoulders, and viciously pushed her back and forth against the kitchen cabinets. I was around 10. I didn't let anyone come over the house after that, minus one time a decade later. And even then I couldn't enjoy myself because I was on pins and needles about my dad's behavior. Other fears followed me into adulthood. I didn't drink until I was 21. Of course, that was the legal age, but I worried so much about becoming an alcoholic like my dad. I knew I was susceptible to addiction because of the number of blood relatives I had who were addicts. I'm thankful for my high tolerance, yet I have to make sure I don't drink when in any sort of volatile state, because that paves the way to addiction. My dad's rants about marriage stuck with me. I struggled with getting close to people. I worried that I could potentially bring that kind of pain to someone else, so I was always wary of getting close to someone, even when I was in pursuit of men. It wasn't until my 30s I had an epiphany. I was attracting unattainable people because I was no less unattainable. I didn't want to be alone, but I didn't know how to let my guard all the way down. I knew how to volunteer the kind of information that gave folks the sense of connection. It was a tactic to throw them off the scent of who I really was and what ate away at me. I became even better at it because the few times I felt I was trying to get close to people, they rejected me or used what I had divulged against me. That deepened my underlying cynicism that falling in love with someone opened the door for them to destroy parts, or all, of me. That was how I saw my parents. I imagined that whatever love they had for each other wasn't enough to overcome their own respective issues. I knew I was not my parents, but I also knew how easy it would be to become like them. In life, people will disappoint you, but the key is to learn how to find within yourself a sense of peace and confidence that keeps you whole during the times when you are let down. I wanted to be better than my father. I didn't want to repeat the cycle. I became obsessed with not doing so, but not necessarily with doing the work to unlearn things, to settle my feelings, and most of all, to let go of my anger. I spent much of my childhood wishing my dad were dead. I understood that I was considered fortunate to have a two-parent household. People would tell me as much. However, because they did not live in that house and endure what we did because of my dad's unsettled trauma and alcoholism, they couldn't get how incredibly stupid that sentiment was when expressed to me. I did not feel lucky. I hated him. I hated him so much that I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill him so much that I carved "Die, Dad, and Mom" into the wall of my childhood bedroom. Him because he was a menace, and her because sometimes I would blame her for keeping us there or because she wasn't always kind herself. Still, most of that fury was aimed at him. I knew how I wanted to kill him to boot. My dad always kept a knife near him. He kept one underneath his bed. I used to fantasize about taking that knife from under his bed and stabbing him profusely until he took his last breath. I thought about that as a child. That is how much I resented him. Once, while he was cursing at my mom and threatening her and then the rest of us, I looked at him in the eye and told him what I wanted to do. I couldn't do it, of course, but even the fact that I thought about it still troubles me deeply. Whenever I go home and sleep in my old room, I sleep beside that carving made in the wall. I loathe seeing it. I tried to scratch it out once, but it's carved in so deep that it can't be totally erased. Neither can the memory of my doing it. I hated him so much because none of us deserved that, especially not my mom. I had to get away for college, both for my big dreams and for a much-needed escape. Of course, my problems followed me. I was a combination of my parents in that I could keep cool like my mom, up to a certain point, but I could also blow up just as ferociously as my father. I kidded myself into thinking I could control that residual anger. Suppression was not the answer. Forgiveness was. Even so, Despite knowing that I needed to change, there remained the rightful presumption that my dad was incapable of giving me a proper sense of calm or closure. He was never going to admit wrongdoing. He was not going to say, I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to get help. I had already heard those false declarations as a kid. He was not the kind of person that opened up in that way. Nor would he ever say, I'm sorry for the pain I caused your mom, your sister, and your brother. My dad was never going to take ownership of having stalled my acting career. As a kid, I used to be in plays in both elementary and middle school. Of course, the one time that my mom appeared to be fed up with my dad enough to divorce him was when I was in middle school and interested in such things. Seemingly unable to stomach his ass any longer, she took us all to our grandparents' house in the middle of the night. After that, we stayed at our aunt's house. Based on the way she was talking to us, she truly seemed fed up. Then my dad followed us. First to our aunt's, and then he rolled up on me in my middle school. I spoke to him but scurried the hell away, because I figured I could be done with him for good. That proved not to be the case. We ended up back home, and barely any time passed before he huffed and puffed and blew all that bullshit back at us. This was near the end of my 8th grade year, and I was applying to schools. My grades were slipping, and my conduct was the worst because I was lashing out at teachers, cursing at them in some cases, and getting into fights. My only real shot at avoiding my zone school was HSPVA, the Performing Arts School in Houston. Naturally, my dad acted a fool damn near to the very day I had to go and audition. I ended up blowing my audition and didn't get in. In my mind, had I gotten in, I would have perfected my craft and gone on to have a successful acting career. I mean, that could have been me playing Bobby Brown in BET's New Edition biopic. I would have tanned. If not, I could have settled on Ronnie DeVoe. But no, my dad took that away. And it was another thing he wasn't going to apologize for. We're not a family sitcom about an affable, affluent family trying to solve life's greatest hurdles in 22 minutes. So I had to minimize my expectations. My dad was an old-ass black man who was not afraid to hurt people. And like many people, including myself, he had been raised not to talk about his problems, but instead to pretend that they didn't exist. The idea was to keep going in spite of them, without admitting that no amount of running from your problems or feigning amnesia about them will prevent them from catching up to you one way or another. I had to create my own level of closure. First, I had to see my dad in totality. He wasn't all bad growing up. I liked the trips he took my brother and me on, where we would catch fish and crabs. I remember the smiles on our faces when he would fillet the fish after we were done and fry everything in the back of his truck. Cooking had always been his way to show affection. The gumbo, the barbecuing, the chicken strips that I obsessed over and always asked for. The fast food he would buy me even though he kept complaining about how expensive it was and that we had food at the house. I appreciated when he would buy the basketball rims, the baseball stuff, and the punching bag. I understood that he tried to be present in the ways that he could be. These gestures did not absolve him or cancel out my fears that one day he might get too drunk and angry and do the unconscionable. But reflecting on the whole story helped, because I was able to humanize him and not only view him at his worst. I didn't forget anything that had happened, but making the conscious choice not to cling to the past as much as I used to do was helpful, as was giving the man the benefit of the doubt. Moreover, if I wanted to have a better rapport with him, I had to make some effort myself. Every so often he would call me, not to talk at length, but just to see if I was alive and if I needed anything. He always said the same thing, I'll dial that number if you need anything, boy. At those times, I barely recognized who the hell was on the other end of that line, and it was a genuine gesture that I often promptly shooed away. He routinely said, I'll give you my last. He would preface it sometimes with, I'm just a poor man, but, or something similar. But no matter how he said it, he did mean it. The intent was to show that he wanted to be there for me in some way, because I was physically present only once or twice a year. When I was, he would turn back to cooking. So I would eat those smoked turkey legs he made for me. When he asked if I needed food, I stopped snipping no and went with, well, you can go ahead and get some seafood boudin and put it on the pit. One time, my dad also offered to stab anyone who might have been fucking with me. Honestly, that was sweet for an old thuggish man who truly would try to fight you even in his 60s. Around the same time, he also called me his nigga. I wish they made greeting cards for statements like that. I've learned to call him on my own without prodding from my mom. I've learned to call him and wish him a happy Father's Day and sound sincere about it. And I now call every so often simply to say hello. The calls do not last long. He'll ask how I'm doing, mention the weather, and once again asks if I need to dial that number. Most times he's pleasant, though there are instances where he bemoans that my siblings and I favor our mom over him. Y'all mama's boys, is what he'll say. I don't fall for the bait, and the second I think I'm going to regress and get irritated, I change the subject or end the call. We don't necessarily know how to hold extensive conversations, but being able to have the short ones we do is significant progress. That's mostly attributed to my ending the call with, "Love you, Pop." We were never really in the habit of saying, "I love you." I always maintained the position that I loved him for giving me life, but left it at that. Now I don't say I love you with an asterisk. I love him, as complicated a figure as he is. And now he says it without my pushing him to do so. It's not that I ever doubted he loved me, but I gather it's not something he was used to saying out loud. He continues to drink, but as far as his rage goes, age has slowed him down. I don't know if he's tired of the fighting or just tired. It's long been time for him to stop all the same. I've come to learn that a lot of things he can't say to me out loud are said to my sister, whom he calls most. Years ago, I did a video for a media outlet about my coming out story. A first cousin from his side of the family found me online through my writing. First, she tried LinkedIn, which I often forget exists, and then she found me on Facebook, where she watched the video. In it, I was blunt about my experiences and my parents' reaction. So my cousin went to my dad and said, "Your sons are gay and it's your fault because you're an alcoholic." My dad did not call me about this. Frankly, I think he knew better than to come to me with it. Instead, he called my sister and said, "I know my boys are gay. It's not my fault, though, and I don't care as long as they're happy." "He said that?" I asked her. My sister said that he had indeed. He also relayed a familiar claim. "I'm not an alcoholic. Alcoholics can't take care of their families." He thinks being functional in one's addiction negates said addiction. I don't bother with that now. Watch your mouth and your hands with my mama and do whatever you want with your liquor. That's another thing I've learned to do. Indulge him when he offers me alcohol. I understand how dicey that is. I worry about whether I'm enabling him. But I've settled on accepting that there are things about him that I cannot change. And I'm not going to turn down free booze. I'm also more inclined to accept his offering because he did not shun me when confronted by some cousin, who I've seen twice in nearly 20 years' time. My sister informed me of something else, too. I never talked with her about our uncle until I was barely 33. I told her that I remember vividly how our father reacted to Daniel's death and all of the faggots he hurled after the funeral. She didn't remember that. I told her that she probably wouldn't because it wouldn't have affected her in the same way. Having said that, some days later, she said she vaguely remembered some of it, only she filled me in with more details about their relationship. She explained to me that my dad and Daniel were incredibly close, to the point where Daniel lived with my parents for a minute. It was her theory that my dad's reaction, as I recalled it, had more to do with his own hurt than anger directed at him. That made sense, given his pattern. There are still some questions that linger in my head. I wonder if he, like me, had those same nightmares of his father killing his mother. Was he also so angry that he wanted to do the worst to his dad in retaliation? Has it ever hit him that he's repeated some of his own dad's mistakes? And if so, did he worry about his own children having a similar fate? I'd ask these questions if I thought I'd get answers. I wouldn't, so I won't. I do know a few things. I know that in spite of his faults, he is a funny, charismatic, hardworking man. Whenever my friends would pick me up to go out in high school, most of them would know how cool my dad, who introduced himself as Doc, was to them. An eye roll was the response I'd given them, given that they had no idea what was going on. But in the interest of fairness, I will admit now that his ass has always been cool. You see it in his old pictures. I also know that he is proud of me. He's never read anything I've written, bless his heart, but he doesn't know how to use a computer, and rules the day he got a smartphone. But I know that he knows I have worked hard to create a life for myself, and as a man, he respects that. He admires what I've accomplished, and I know this based on how his friends know that I went to Howard, that I lived in LA and New York, and that I've gone a lot farther than most people who grew up around us. The one and only time he's been on a plane was to see me graduate from college. He needed a tranquilizer in order to sit still for the flight. Washington, D.C. was an unrecognizable world to him, but thanks to the hotel workers, whom he managed to befriend fast and who told him that he looked like Cat Williams, he enjoyed a certain familiarity and comfort. Most of all, I know that he knows that when I used to look at him eye to eye, love was not in my sight. But now when I say I love you over the phone, or begin hugging him goodbye as I leave Houston again, he knows I mean it. When I look in the mirror, I mostly see my mom's face. But from certain angles and with certain expressions, my dad is there too. In the past, this would make me angry or bring me to near